number of them have plenty of room. And what they like to do, one guy asked me, he put up a loop antenna, but he's got it in the vertical instead of a horizontal loop like I have. He has it in a vertical, and it comes within 10 feet of ground. In other words, the top of one side, it goes up 75, and 65 feet across, down 75 again, and then back to the feed point at the bottom section. And he would like to know how he would, if he wanted to put one behind it. In other words, he'd like to put four of them up now. One set to be for north-south, the other one for east-west. How does he go about figuring, or is there such a thing as a modeling of how much distance between the loops does take over?
Yes, Glenn, I just wanted to give Andy a report. I'm on the Selden repeater. I know he's done a lot of work, Dick, so I feel that I should give Andy a decent report. How's this?
Sounds quite good to me. What do you think, Andy?
Yeah, the crackly noise is gone. I'm not sure if it's the repeater, if it's on your signal, Paul. Because I don't usually hear any noise on the repeater. So it's possible. I just wanted to make a comparison. But you sound fine on the east end. That's good.
Okay, Andy. Very good. I thought I'd give it a shot before we got any later. WH2CDLWS2N. Thanks, Andy.
Is it me, Andy, or do you hear a tiny bit of grumble pretty easy down when he was talking through the link? And is that a normal sound the link makes?
Yeah, I don't want to interrupt Mel too much. Yeah, there's some issues with the link regarding IOLT, some clocking noise going on, and some other glitches, and the levels are a little bit off. They have to be readjusted, but overall it sounds okay. But I do notice that. That's what you're right.
Very minor detail. It sounds awfully good. Now, when it comes to Mel's question, every antenna has an electronic phase center. In the case of a vertically polarized full wavelength loop, I'm thinking now about it really does have two phase centers. They are already a quarter wave apart. And to be vertically polarized, I guess he's feeding one of the vertical legs of this loop. Maybe he's using a balancing device or a coil of coax cable to act like a coaxial RF choke. And now he wants to mount a second antenna behind the first. By the way, the antennas are going to radiate coplanar. In other words, if I set up the plane of the loop so that the plane faces east-west and the normal is north-south, normal to the plane of the loop, I think that automatically is a east-west antenna. And now he wants to set up another one east or west of that to make a dual element phased array, is what I think he's talking about. Well, and how far apart should he make them? He's got a number of choices. There are very curves in the Antenna Engineering Handbook which show simpler antennas, quarter reflectors, dipoles, and things like this, where various spacings between the elements of the antenna, various phase shifts between the two and the way you feed them, make it into an end fire that will fire east or west. By electronic steering, he could now fire this thing east or west, and he could create a significant front-to-back ratio. I think the right answer is 65 feet, roughly quarter wave. But I'm going to have to study the book on this one. I'm not sure. I've never seen anybody make a phased array out of vertically polarized full-wavelength loops. But there's no reason why that shouldn't fly like a charm. You're a little more familiar with 80 meters than I am, Mel. Have any of those big gun guys out there in California ever made a phased array of vertically polarized full wave loops? K2JEY, K2LIW?
In a way, okay. He's back it up a little bit here. In other words, what he's looking to do, he's looking to make a stationary quad. Think of it basically, what is a quad? It's basically a full wave square loop. And in other words, is there a standard procedure for determining the space? Let's take a quad that Mike Rich is purchasing, I think, one for what, 20 meters? That quad. I don't know what the, I know the spacing is fairly close on that quad. In fact, that's what they advertise it, that is for a person that has a limited turning radius and still wants to put up some kind of a so-called directional antenna, that they basically sell it with that kind of advertising, that is a, spacing is fairly close considering the frequency. In other words, how close can you make two quad elements? They can still show front to back and some forward gain, I guess, on it, over.
Believe it or not, you can always get front to back at essentially any spacing if you have the right phase shift between the two that you're feeding, if it's an all-fed array. And the more I think about it, a typical quad radiates broadside. Yeah, it radiates broadside. And a full typical quad is a one-wavelength loop. So he could stack a pair of vertically polarized full wavelength loops. The normals would be collinear to each other. In other words, a post, so to speak, at right angles to the plane of the loop for the first loop and the plane of the second loop, those two will be sharing the same axial rod, so to speak. And there is probably a most desirable spacing that will give us the highest possible forward directivity. But when it comes to front-to-back ratio, with the proper amplitude and phase of the two, he can make a front-to-back ratio. He can create a null in the back lobe at almost any spacing. When the spacing becomes extremely close, much more careful tuning is required to create that null. But if, for instance, he chose quarter wavelengths of spacing, and if he fed them exactly a quarter wavelength out of phase, he'd fire with the main lobe in one direction, and there would be a deep null in the other direction. Now, what complicates things a little bit is that to feed them a quarter wave out of phase, if they're a quarter wave apart, or an eighth wave out of phase, if they're an eighth wave apart, is the fact that making the phasing of the feed, let me drop, come out right, is not as easy as it sounds, because there is cross-coupling between the loops. I could make up a phasing harness where the output of the phasing harness is exactly 90 degrees out of phase for the two feed points at equal in amplitude. Hook them up to the real antennas, and the 90 degrees is going to shift to some number of other degrees because of the cross-coupling between the loops. So therefore, some further retuning is required. And this is a deterministic problem. In other words, with the right computer modeling program, you could readjust the phasing harness accordingly to accommodate the cross-coupling between the loops and make them come out exactly at the phase you want. But if the final feeding of the two loops is 90 degrees out of phase, which equals a quarter wavelength, and if physically in space they are a quarter wave apart, I know under that condition you're going to get some very fine forward lobe, and with proper tuning, as deep a null in the front-to-back ratio as you want in the plane of the axis of the two antennas, if you know what I mean. Now, whether or not you're going to get that deep a null at some other angle in space where your space wave is really favoring, that's another whole problem. Let me think of that. With vertical polarization, you don't get phase shift on ground reflection. That makes life a lot easier. This could be a very good low-angle antenna, and it could have an additional 3 dB of gain and a fantastic front-to-back ratio. How far downrange is the person who's actually building this, do you think, Mel? And how else do you know who has built it? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Where the problem lies. There are, I don't know if anybody has built that exactly like that. There was one guy in, also in Pennsylvania, that set up for 40 meters. They had a 40 meter, during the 40 meter had a contest going. Being the hot contest, you know, these guys in the contest, they're passionate to be able to sit by the radio for a solid day without a let up. You know, this takes some doing. I don't think I could possibly do it, but because I've never been able to ever spend more than a short time, you know, contesting or getting to. But to give you an idea, this one contest station, he found that, the complaints on 40-meter contests, that many of the East Coast stations are never heard over in parts of Asia, or I should say the Far East. Of Japan and China and that areas of the world, they seem to lose the point from East Coast amateurs. So they went ahead and they used the Delta Loop. This one station, he used Delta Loop. He set up the Delta Loop. Actually, he used a rope loop. He tied a rope from one place to another place, and then he put the Delta Loops all down the line, about 8 elements of them, and just pulled it up. Just actually pulled it up, anchored down, the apex was on the rope, and then the end, each end of the triangle were staked down, and it was aimed directly out towards the Japanese island and all, and he was the only station that really was heard that had consistent pile-up on it from the East Coast here to that part of the world during the contest day. He said it required for 8 elements to how he worked it out. He claimed it was 325 feet of spacing overall. That's over.
That's an antenna. Wow. An 8 element, 80 meter Delta Loop Yagi, if I understand you correctly. What's your best guess, Mel? Was that horizontally or vertically polarized?
This is K2K. Why, somebody want to make a comment before I go ahead? Well, somebody wants to say something. No, 40 meters, the fixed antenna. In other words, you just tied a rope between two supports and just went along that rope. He tied the wire. In other words, the wire element antenna. They're all vertically polarized, all the Delta Loops. And he just pulled it up and then just staked down. You know, it was a temporary installation. It was not permanent. It was for a contest. They're a big contest group over there in Pennsylvania. In fact, they even marked it. His design, Dick, is marketed as the that four square with a face on it that Barry wanted to purchase. It's his design, K3LR. So you go take a look at his antenna field. I don't know how many towers they've got there and all. And the station has got like 10 different positions and all with kilowatts. It's a whole big deal. But the only way they could achieve this, that's what they said, was this fixed antenna that they roped up using this, I guess you could call it a rope boom, and just tied these Delta Loops through this rope and pull them up and take them down, Dick. And it said it was 325 feet of rope and 8 elements on it, Dick, over.
And the main rope supporting the 8 elements, I think, was one great big catenary, if I understand correctly, with all the individual apexes of the elements all properly lengthened with rope. The ropes are lengthened, the length of the rope properly set. Now, in the case of a Delta Loop, where the apex is high of each individual element and the flat side of the triangle is parallel to the ground, feeding that for horizontal polarization on the driven element is easy. Feeding that for vertical polarization is a little bit more complicated. I wonder how they did that. And, believe it or not, the way the RF works. All of your parasitic elements could be delta loops, and the driven element could be any other kind of loop, round, square, upside down, triangle, whatever you like. The RF wouldn't know the difference. So you could make the driven element the one that's an upside down triangle and feed it at the top, right across the horizontal bar of the top. So how did you choose the vertical polarization feed point on the driven element of this 8-element 40-meter delta loop? What an antenna. And I think you're saying if I go to the website of Kilo 3, Lima Romeo, I will see this thing, is what I think you're saying. Back to you, Mel.
I don't know if it's still on there, because that was a couple of years ago, but you'll definitely see the rest of this antenna field. It's beyond comprehension. You would never believe what you're going to see. How did they feed it? I think he fed it as the one element. He had one as the reflector, and then he had the driven. And I think the driven element, basically, they split it down on a corner of that one delta loop, I believe. They split it at that corner, and that corner feed. Now, these loops, actually, they were basically full-wave loops. In other words, instead of in a quad, you know, a square type configuration, they did them in a delta configuration, in a triangular configuration. Now the point is, let's not vision a monstrosity like this. No, that's not within our realm of experiment. Let's say we want to make a quad for this band where we are right now. Who needs a quad? What is the rule of thumb for spacing between reflector, director, and driven elements, and how many directors can we put on there, and how would we determine, in other words, spacing? Because I think whatever you would do here should work formula-wise, but theoretically, it would be the same thing if we went to 40 or 80 meters thick over.
Absolutely. And this is going to sound funny. I recommend you don't go beyond 102 total elements. The reason I said that is because the longest Yagi I know of with confirmed real performance is the 102 element Yagi on, I think it's 3.3 gigahertz, manufactured by Directive Systems. The president of the company is K1WHS, Dave Oline, in Lebanon, Maine. So he's got an antenna with confirmed performance on an antenna range during one of the VHF conferences, and there's one coming up in April, by the way, the New England VHF conference, which will be held in Enfield, Connecticut. I'm not sure of the exact date. I think I'll be there, but I'm not positive. And Dave will be there. Now, what a Yagi is, whether you make the elements of the Yagi as dipoles, as loops, as squares, cubical quads, as triangles, that's your choice. That's the mechanical engineering part of the project, of the drop. But a Yagi is a number of resonators where each one has the right resonant frequency and each one has the right position in space. Everything I know about long Yagis, I'm calling it long Yagi anything more than about four or five elements. Everything I know about long Yagis tells me that I could take someone's dipole design Yagi that was designed for 432 or 1296 with proper scaling techniques. I can build a wire loop version of that, delta loop wire version of that, down on 40 meters, and get the exact same performance, as long as I'm smart enough to properly model each one of those delta loops so that each one of them has the right resonant frequency, period. So, as I said, a Yagi is a bunch of resonators, each one having the right resonant frequency and the right position in three-dimensional space. You do that, and the end-fire phenomena happens. Now, is there a magic formula for the best possible Yagi? I can almost say no. Let me drop. Lots of computer modeling programs like YO, Yagi Optimization, and NEC and MiniNEC and so on, lots of these modeling programs will model your particular Yagi and you, and who makes the world's best Yagi? Well, Gunter Hawk, DL6WU, probably has the most documented set of articles telling you the true performance of the world's best Yagi. And you'd like to believe there is one design that's the optimum, period. Ain't true. Some of them have a little bit more bandwidth. Some of them have a little bit more front-to-back ratio. When well-tuned, they all come very close to the same forward gain. So, there are various Yagi designs with a little bit of research, and I would start off with DL6W, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform. I would start off with his design. They are, if not the world's best, they're darn close to the world's best. He has put most of his lifetime into that project. It's just a passion he's had for, let's say, 45 years. He is Dr. Herr Yagi in Germany, in Darmstadt, Germany, I think he lives. So, started with his design, make your own Delta Loop version. Now, a little bit of difficulty will take place when you take a dipole length that has a certain calculated resonant frequency and make a Delta Loop version of it mounted wavelength-wise in the same position in space and make it have the right resonant frequency. That part's going to take a little bit of study. But I know it's doable. I didn't give you an answer. I told you a little bit about how to get from here to there, Bell Mel. K2KEY, K2LAW.
This is K2KEY, basically
Bell
Mel, said the same thing, but I said I will ask because I could not really come up with an answer. How do you really determine correct spacing in that type of situation? Do you do it by hitting this? Do you do it by some kind of antenna modeling? I tried, I looked, I do not see any kind of antenna modeling. In fact, it's very strange that the, like you say, well, quad, what are you taking a quad? Maybe folding the elements over and making a dipole into a quad, you know, like you say, just mechanically reshaping things. But the point is, the modeling for a Yagi antenna for spacing, optimum spacing, things like that, does it behave in the same law of reciprocity? Same thing for when you make it into a quad. Does something happen? In other words, you know, you can twist the dipole so many different ways, but we know there are things that do take place when you start, you know, putting into a dipole, such as an inverted V or a folded dipole and all. There are patents switches that do patent changes. What happens when we go to a quad? In other words, this quad that I think Rich was interested in, on 20 meters, I think I looked at it, the spacing between the elements is about, I think, 8 feet for now a frequency of 14 megahertz. Would you say that kind of, that's normal, kind of close, because you got, you know, the element to spacing ratio is very small, Vic, over.
All good Yagis do that, Bill. You and I, using our eyesight, which has got extremely high resolution by radio frequency standards, if I was building a 20-meter Yagi, 20 meters is 65 feet wavelength, and each of the elements, if I was building ordinary dipole-type Yagi, each of the elements are around a half wavelength long, around 31 or so feet for many of the elements. That's not the exact number, but that's the ballpark figure. That RF energy with a 60-foot wavelength does not see the details of those individual directors, reflector, and driven elements. eye with extremely high resolution sees all those fine details, sees the shininess of the aluminum, the diameter of the aluminum rods, whether or not they taper, how they're mounted to the boom. We see all those fine details. That radio wave coming from space with a 60-foot wavelength to it knows it has encompassed, it has encountered a Yagi because it senses a synthesized dielectric structure. Those individual elements of the right resonant frequency and the right position in space are a skeleton equivalent of that dial guide antenna, of that foam fiberglass, of that foam magnifying glass, or that plexiglass type of antenna you put at the end of a waveguide that we've discussed in past TechNet. That RF wave can't tell the difference between a blob of plastic of the right shape and the right dielectric constant, or the light refractive index, depending on what terms you want to use, versus your synthesized skeleton structure that behaves in the same way that you and I call the director string of the Yagi. It is a synthesized slow wave structure. That wave, when it hits the plastic, propagates more slowly and gets focused. That wave, when it hits your director string, sees those resonant frequencies that are tuned above resonance. They present a capacitive loading to the free space around those elements. The wave propagates more slowly down the center of that boom than it does off to one side of the boom. That's the focusing action. So whether you make the elements in dipole-like manner, fat, skinny dipole, drooping down as a inverted V, drooping up as a V, a complete circle of a wavelength, a complete triangle as a wavelength, a complete square as a wavelength, all of that is the fine detail. The wave does not see that. We amateurs have argued to the wee hours of the morning as to whether or not a cubical quad of, let's say, three elements has more gain or less gain.
More gain
or less gain than a three-element Yagi built out of dipoles. And I think the answer has come out that if there is a difference, the difference is extremely small, and the latest data, carefully documented by Wayne Overback, seems to say that the Yagi-like structure has a tiny bit more gain than the cubical quad. Now, you may have fallen in love with cubical quads because you like their mechanical construction, you like their low wind load, or you just like the beauty of that great big chunk of thing in space, that skeleton structure. But if you want the absolute maximum in gain, there might be a tiny bit more gain in a Yagi-like structure, in a dipole Yagi, than there is in the cubical quad. But the difference is extremely small because the RF wave does not see those details. And the little bit of loss of not quite the same amount of gain in the cubical quad versus the dipole, I think, is only a function of the resistivity of a, let's say, 1.5-inch diameter element that I would build the Yagi on 20 meters with on out of aluminum tubing as a dipole, as opposed to the skinnier wire I would use for making a cubical quad. If there really is a difference between the two, I think it's a minor difference in resistivity of the materials based on their diameter. Other than that, I say the RF wave doesn't see the difference. Choose somebody's good Yagi design. It would be great if it was already a cubical quad, but if you find somebody's good Yagi design built with dipole elements, if you're smart enough in the way you do the modeling, you can make your individual delta loop elements have the exact same resonant frequency as those dipole elements, mount them at the same positions in space, you will get the same performance. A Yagi is a bunch of individual resonators all in the right position in space. That's it. Make those resonators out of squares, round, dipoles, the initials of your name, whatever, as long as you got the right resonant frequency in your polarization of interest. That's a strongly felt opinion. K2KDY, K2LIW.
2E06. Hey, Rich, got me 1 second. This is K2KDY. Yeah, that's it, you know. I'm going to go the other way. Number of these different antenna manufacturers advertise superior performance of our Yagi because it is wide-based. wide space Yagi. Long boom Yagi. Now, what are we actually achieving? What are they supposedly trying to, well, you know, I could say, you know, looking at antenna advertisements are very funny. they're very peculiar, these things. Don't really use them as the gospel, but you've been seeing that for so many years. Wide space Yagi, long boom versus superior because of long boom. Is this all a bunch of, in other words, hype? Or am I going to see the same thing if I close space the element? So I don't know what the minimum close space you can go to, but if I took that same antenna, close spaced it, retrim the elements, keep them, I'm sure you most likely have to change the length of the elements. So would I see in the same antenna, now that I short the boom down, close spaced it, made the initial adjustment, what will I actually see? Am I going to see a different front to back? Am I going to see a different forward gain? Or am I going to see nothing? It's over.
Yeah, most of that wide space jazz, which was first used as an advertising traction idea by Telrex in the mid-50s, 1956 roughly, QST magazine. Lots of hype was used about the superiority of a wide space Yagi. After a lifetime of study, what Gunter Hawk has discovered, as I read his articles, what I think he's saying pretty strongly is that the maximum gain you get out of a boom is strictly a function of the length of the boom once you've done a good tuning job. Give me the number of wavelengths of boom in his equation. He will tell you exactly how many decibels of forward gain you're going to get. Now, there's an optimum way or a nearly optimum way of stacking those elements along the boom. But the gain is the length of the boom. You could, if you're a little bit crazy, try to get the maximum amount of gain per element. The reason that's crazy is the elements are not the investment. It's the boom you're supporting that's the investment. If I'm putting a great big long Yagi out there, state-of-the-art on 2 meters, and I use 32 feet of boom, I have to use some good, smart mechanical engineering to properly support 32 feet of boom without grinding up a rotator and without having the wind collapse the darn thing onto my roof. The investment you make is the length of the boom. The number of elements you put on that boom is secondary. You can count elements if you want. I can also count how many angels I could put on the head of a pin. In both cases, it misses the point, I think. Length of boom is the gain. Properly stack the elements on that boom, you'll maximize and get that gain. If I was foolish enough to count the number of elements, I could go for a little bit lower gain on the boom by using a smaller number of elements, but if I now count gain per element, I'll think I'm coming out ahead. But I'm now using wider space because I put a smaller number of elements on that boom. I didn't get the most amount of gain I could get out of that boom. Gain is length once you do a good tuning job. So most of this wide space jazz, to me, is advertising hyperbole. I've heard a couple of fairly well-informed antenna engineers say those words. I think it's the right way of looking at the problem. Rich, I know you wanted to, you're about to buy a cubicle quad, and here I am saying mildly disparaging things about them. I was pretty sure you'd want to know a little bit more about it. N2EO, KQLIW.
Okay,
take
N2EO. Well, I give you some other advantages to a quad over a Yagi. They're a lower Q antenna, which means you QSY up and down the band with a better match to the transmitter. And I'll tell you, I had years ago. Also, there's no traction. So in my case, anyone can run tons of power into the quads without having to worry about burning up tracks. I can tell you this. I had a quad years ago from about 1968 to 1974. 75, 74. We had a terrible ice storm. The beans came down in that ice storm. And then I put up a Mosley TA-33 tri-band Aggie, following spring. And I can tell you, the quad was much familiar, had a much better. I know when I was sleeping Mosley, I didn't get the front to back or front to side when I was sweeping across the signal that I got with the cubicle quad. And this signal seemed to be louder. I mean, I didn't make any comparative tests, but going from winter into spring when I made the change, it seems like I went backwards when I went to the Yankee versus the 2-element quad. Back to that in 2 weeks.
Hey, fine, Rich. You're the third guy tonight who's getting a little bit noisy on the input. I think there's some extra wind or precipitation static or something going on at Glen Oaks tonight. That's what I think is going on. I can't believe that George, Paul, and now Rich all have the exact same noise on their transmitter. No problem. We heard every word, so don't worry yet, Rich. So cubicle quad, greater bandwidth, greater VisWAM bandwidth, not as much retuning. Interesting. I think I might agree with that. At least I don't know anything to disagree with about that. You believe it is a lower Q structure. And you might be right. But it isn't because the structure itself is lower in Q. It's the way the structure is being fed. The mechanism by which you tend to feed a cubicle quad versus the mechanism by which you tend to feed the driven element of a Yagi. There's the real difference. If you take a look at, let me drop, take a look at the December issue, 2006, Antennas and Propagation. I can't think of the name of the two articles, but it is a end-loaded sleeve dipole type, dipole-like antenna. A dipole normally has something in the vicinity of 15% bandwidth, 3 dB bandwidth. Now these guys have added these extra parasitic-like structures on a printed circuit dipole. They did the work at 1,000 megs, but it doesn't matter. They added these extra structures alongside that look like a director in the front and a director in the back. They're identical in size. It really is making a sleeve dipole. And now the dipole is 2-to-1 broad, 100% bandwidth, you could say, instead of 15% bandwidth. I built one of those at 1,000 megs, just like the article. It does exactly what they said. It's a well-done article. So, there are sophisticated ways of feeding a driven element of a dipole to make it super broadband. So, it is not the basic Q of the elements of quad versus dipole that's doing it. I think the difference is in the way they're fed. You allow me to use the right kind of doodads on the driven element of a Yagi, a dipole-like Yagi, and I think I can make the VisWAM bandwidth very broad. I didn't say the gain bandwidth, the front-to-back ratio bandwidth is going to be broad. I can make the VisWAM bandwidth very broad, and that's what you are discussing. So I don't think it's quad versus dipole. I think it's feeding mechanism. Another strongly felt opinion on my part. K2KEY, KQLIW.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now, I didn't have any special feeding years ago. I fed the coax right in directly without any subs or matching intuitive right at the full wave elements. And it had a very wide bandwidth. I can go up and down below it to CW right up to the top end of the phone on 20 meters. Also, another advantage to the quad is that at least according to Bill Orr, a 2-element cubicle quad is about equivalent to a 3-element tri-band a 3-element monoband gag. So really what he said years ago was that you don't tend to be 20-meter quad, it's like having 3 monobands up there.
Okay, you're telling us what Bill Orr said. And what Bill Orr really believed. But much later in time, 25 years later, along comes a pretty serious guy who I've met, I think he's a straight arrow, named Wayne Overbeck, who went and made measurements and didn't confirm the two-element quad being a three-element Yagi. He did not confirm that. Second of all, you did feed the element directly, coax cable, maybe with or without a balancing device, directly to the wire. The driven element of a Yagi rarely is fed that way. There's a hairpin structure, there's a delta, there's a gamma, there's a folded dipole. There's all kinds of ways of feeding the driven element of a dipole-like Yagi. Not many people bring the coax cable right to the center of the two halves of the driven element. You see where I'm going with that, Rich? Go ahead.
Okay, well, I can tell you what service wanted, Dick. Now, the Cubex, what they recommend is a quarter-wave section of 75 online, which I will be getting from them. They say on 10, it's going to be a 5-band quad, 10, 12, 15, and, 10, 12, 15 meters. They recommend feeding to a quarter-wave section of 75 online. And on 17 to 20, feeding it directly.
Understand, but I'm having a little trouble believing that the quad itself is more broadband. I think the way you feed it makes a big difference. You allow me to use these elaborate dipole feeding techniques that are in that issue of antennas and propagation, I can give you 100% bandwidth of the visual of the driven element. So feeding, I think, is more determining of the bandwidth. Feeding mechanism is more a bandwidth determining mechanism than whether or not the construction is made in a dipole manner, a cubicle quad manner, a delta loop, or a loop manner. That's an opinion. I'm not positive. I haven't actually run the test. I'm telling you what I believe and where it's coming from. Mel? Did we get close to what the guy was asking in your opinion? Maybe we didn't yet. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Basically, what he was asking is, what is the rule of thumb for the spacing between elements on a cubicle quad? Now, that one that Rich is looking at, I don't know if he purchased it yet. Rich, am I correct that you said that the spacing between the elements, I believe it's a two-element quad, was approximately around 8 feet. Is that correct, Rich? Over.
Correct, Mel. It's exactly 8 feet. That's the standard on two-element quads for 30 or 40 years.
Okay, so, Dick, if we took that 8 feet versus frequency, can we expand that and say, well, we're going to go somewhat lower in frequency, we're going to build a somewhat bigger quad, but we're basing it on the same consideration that if it worked with an 8-foot spacing at 14 megs at that ratio, we use that same ratio and do it on 80 meters, over.
If you're comparing a two-element antenna on band A to a two-element band antenna on band B, absolutely. But if you're now building that 8-element 40-meter thing, lots of people will fall into the trap of saying that, gee, a 2-element antenna should have this spacing, or a 3-element Yagi should have that spacing, and now I'm going to use that same spacing, just add a whole bunch more elements, and I'm going to build an 8-element version of it. That, to some degree, does not work. As you start adding more and more elements, all of the elements have to be retuned in there. Resonant length and positions if you want optimum performance. So you just don't add on to somebody's design. To duplicate somebody's design on another band with another method of construction, I agree with that. But be careful about this, what I'm going to call cascading function. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, I just looked up the quote from Gunther Hawk. Quad. This is K1. And I know I saw some review on him. I have a whole pile here. I've got about 18 inches high pile of antenna information, but I knew I could put my finger on this about 20-meter antenna, 20-meter quads versus Yagis. In his opinion, while the quad, he says, will consistently exhibit approximately a 0.5 dB more gain over the entire 20-meter band, its front-to-ratio to rear ratio isn't as quite as good as the Yagi. In other words, the FBR, he says, is not as good as the Yagi over the same band of frequency. He says the best you can attain with a quad is 25 dB front to rear. But it falls 17 dBs at the bottom end of the band and 15 dBs on the top end of the band. However, a well-designed Yagi will exhibit 21 dBs across the entire 20-meter band. The quad SWR is to just under 3 to 1 at the top end of the band, but stays below 2 to 1 from 14 to approximately 14.35. The Yagi will exhibit SWR lower and can be obtained, can be built to show a 1.5 over the entire 20-meter band. That's the corny statistic on the hot stick, over.
Interesting. So he's implying the Yagi is a little bit more broadband, but he may be doing a little bit of apple and orange here. Not only quad to Yagi dipole type comparison, but slightly different methods of feeding the driven element, I think. And even if the driven element looks like it's being fed the same way, you got different local parasitic capacitances and things like this. Now, it's interesting that he thinks the quad has got half a dB more gain. That's not what Wayne Oberbeck found. And I wonder how much of what Gunter is talking about really was measured, and maybe it was. And even if it's true for a two-element quad, is it true for a three-element quad or for a three-element Yagi? I know that a number of guys in the early 70s, when I was hot and heavy on 432, a number of people had built 8, 10, 15-element cubicle quads for 432, and they thought they were getting a lot more gain. When we actually started doing measurements at antenna gain contests, it was not confirmed. Now, maybe the designs were not carefully enough done. Let me drop. But the long, Yagi-like thing, built on wooden booms, cubicle quads on 432, said the A2SVG, I think was his name, is his call letters, a guy who lived in Hempstead, a violin maker, very good, serious microwave ham radio operator, Vince O'Brien was his name, built a 15-element cubicle quad, carefully done. It had good performance, but it wasn't better than an equal number of elements built in a dipole matter. When it was submitted to an antenna gain competition in New Jersey, it did well, but it wasn't a winner. I think it was a 3/4 of a dB shy, something like that, for that length of boom. Back to you, Mel. K2KE1, K2LIW.
Okay, he goes on to say here, in all tests that we have made on different bands, such as for 15 meters, I performed a test on a 5-element quad and a 5-element Yagi. They were both on a 26-foot boom. The quad is still the lead in gain, but not by very much. Let's see, and the somewhat less flat SWR curve than the Yagi. It was somewhat flatter. Okay. Now, he says, I will debunk one belief that some quad enthusiasts said that they need not be mounted very high off the ground to give excellent performance. And the supposedly, it was believed that a quad at the same height is superior to a Yagi at the same height. This is wishful thinking. The only thing I will say, that because many times what is it turning over, you will find sometimes the quad is more forgiving when it's being turned over various different objects, such as pipes and other things that you will find in many locations, ground, different ground situations. The quads seem to be more forgiving than the Aggies. But other than that, there is restlessness or wishful thinking. In other words, the Aggie and the quad, so-called free space, going to be very identical situations to take over.
Yeah, my take on that is I'm trying to picture myself as that RF wave on, say, 20 meters, 63 or whatever, 65 feet of wavelength, and it comes into that structure. It does not see those details. It looks at that artificial dielectric material made out of directors. There's lots of different ways you can make those directors. Interesting stuff. This Gunter Hawk material you're quoting, what is the reference? Was it something he wrote in the German magazine, Mel, and you made a copy of it? Go ahead.
Actually, somebody sent me a, because, you know, I get a lot of mail on, you know, antennas, and these guys know I'm an aficionado. I always tell them, of course, I'm second banana to you, Dick, KQRIW, but I always tell them what we discuss. So anytime these guys are 75 feet find something, they make a copy of it, and I get it in the mail. Now, it goes on, one more thing he says here. The quad does indeed have slightly more gain than the Aggie with the same boom. Now, why is this in free space? It is evident by the slight compression of the quad main lobe. But it's more obvious when you look at the third lobe, which peaks at approximately around 50 degree elevation. In effect, the quad squeezes some energy out of its second and third lobe, and so adds to the first lobe, and the difference in gain to a Yagi can be approximately somewhere between 0.5 and 0.88 dB for the particular quad designed at a 9 degree elevation takeoff angle. Dick, over.
Interesting. A quad really is a vertical stacking of two horizontal dipoles with curved ends. The bottom half is curved up and the upper half is curved down. Interesting. So he's saying that vertical stacking does create a little bit of directivity up at that high elevation angle where a horizontally polarized antenna with ground reflection and the mirror image below the ground, the real antenna above the ground, tends to favor certain elevation angles depending on the altitude above the ground. Interesting. Good stuff. Do you realize, Mel, that in your and my lifetime, we're not going to settle for what is the ideal antenna, not for any one single band, not under any one condition. We're going to be discussing this the day we draw our last breath, Mel. I don't mean to be depressing. KQKEY, KQRIW.
Leo.
Rich, give me 1 second. This is KQKEY. He goes on to say, this is the best part. He goes on and says, don't bother going through all these tests of putting up these two antennas and trying to tell the difference. Because let me tell you, he says the bottom line, he says nobody is going to hear the difference between your three-element quad or your three-element Yagi. So he says that's it. In other words, this controversy has been going on, you know how many years you've heard these discussions over and over again. And here he is, he just says it here. He says nobody's ever going to be able to tell the difference, Dick. He tells you, don't waste your time in trying to make your own comparisons, because I think he more or less looked at it from every angle and every which way, and that's it. So that 0.5 to 0.8 dB is really, you know, like they say, splitting hairs. Go ahead, Rich.
What I found in the real world, when you put up like a tri-band, yag, trap, compromise both sides versus the quad. Quad performs better, how can I put it, in less of a compromised antenna. I think maybe if you compare a two-element quad to a three-element or two-element mono band Yagi, and you have the room to put folks up, the Yagi maybe is good. But I found at least a great situation here with being crowded in the neighbors. The quad outperforms a tri-band Yagi. More accurate like a mono band, like a mono band B. What I did years ago was when I had that quad thing, now I point to the back of the station and with a head, and I put the stubs on the back, two stubs to maximum front to back ratio. In other words, minimum signal of the gentleman with the antenna facing him on the back. And I'll tell you, I got some very good patterns out of that antenna. Not to be duplicated with a mostly tri-band. Back to you, Dick, and to me.
Good stuff. I got to put more antlers up. How about you, Mel? Is your tower loaded with as many antennas as it can tolerate? I know I got to put more antennas in my tower. I got cables going up there without antennas connected to them. Gotta do something about that. 2 meters is nice, but I'm missing some of the other bands I used to. I did a lot of work for a lot of years on 432. Let me think, from roughly 1969 to roughly 1986 when Hurricane Gloria yanked that array of 16 Yagis off my tower. That's 16 years. I had 16 years of every single day. Being almost every single day being on the 432 band. It was to the point there, Mel, where the guys in Long Island in, say, 1975, if I missed some night getting on 432, people would call me up on the telephone and say, are you sick? I bet you got things like that. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Oh, I got the group I lead on 75 meters three nights a week. And that is a really group went on Friday night, went on until close to 3 o'clock in the morning. The discussion, now is this new webcam business. You know, that these guys are sitting and looking at each other while they're talking to each other. Now, wait a minute. Let's just stay with that tennis chair that we were talking. Rich brought up a good point just now, and I'd like to maybe we explore this a little further. Are you better with a monoband antenna versus a tri-band? In other words, would you be better to put up 3 elements for 20, 3 for 10, 15, and 3 for 10, rather than go to a 3-element tri-band? Do you think there's an advantage of monoband? Now, that was another thing that remembered to sell. You're right. Element was the worst offender with their antennas. Why facing their model band antennas and all that jazz is there any truth to any of the things that that Telerex said or that was hype? Also, that mono band antennas are better than tri-band for the same number of elements. Think over.
I think the answer to that, Mel, is yes and no. If a guy builds a mono bander and does a careful job of tuning it, he can get nice performance. If a guy builds a Yagi tri-bander and doesn't spend enough time working on the interaction between the elements, he can end up with a mediocre performance antenna, and you can easily conclude that a tri-bander on any one band is lower in performance than a mono-bander on any one of those bands. You can easily come to that conclusion. Excuse me. But everything I know about antennas tells me that if you do a careful enough tuning job of the tri-bander, at least at the tuned frequency, there's nothing stopping you from getting from the same boom length, the same amount of gain on each one of those bands on the tri-bander. There's a slim chance that as they go to the end of the band, that the tri-bander degrades a little bit more rapidly than a mono band when I get away from the design frequency. but that's a minor issue again. So, are there banders that are lower in performance than mono banders? Probably so. But I think it's because the designer didn't put in enough elbow grease doing the tuning of the interaction. All of that interaction can be retuned out. I could have a vertically polarized Yagi with the mast mounted in the middle of the Yagi. If I'm smart enough, I can retune those nearby directors to bring them back into the right resonant frequency, even though they're in the proximity of that mast, and therefore it's adding capacitance to the tips of the element and tuning it to a lower frequency. You just take a horizontally designed Yagi and simply mount it vertically with a mast in the middle, you're going to detune it. If you're smart enough, you can bring it back into tuning. If you can do it there with that vertically polarized, it used to be horizontal design Yagi, I know you can do it on a tri-bander. Back to you, Mel.
Okay. Rich, did you want to ask a question or make a statement before I go ahead?
No, Mel. Listen to the question. I was going to make another comment, and that was that I think Mr. Hunt talked about a 9, 57, 9 between takeoff angle on the one, and it kind of went by everybody. You know, 9 degrees is a very low takeoff angle, very good for long haul DX. I don't know if you get that type of a low takeoff angle on the Yagi.
I think the main determining factor of where is your first lobe of takeoff angle is the number of wavelengths the antenna is mounted above the ground. That moment off is so powerful because of Earth reflection. You've got a real antenna above the ground, you've got a mirror image of one below the ground, and those two fighting each other force that vertical lobe to be in some particular point in space. You're going to get a little bit of difference of quad versus Yagi on that, but the big moment off, the thing that's got the hair on its chest, the thing that really does it, is number of wavelengths above the ground. And I'll bet you Gunter is talking about a significant number of wavelengths above the ground of that antenna that had the 9-degree takeoff angle. What do you think, Mel?
Certainly, this is a 2-page wide. That's what he specifies here. 3 spaces. Everything here he is doing, just to make all everything equal, give everybody an equal, you know, testing situation. And he says here, the quads and Yagi's gain and everything is computed with the same boom length, and it has been 3 spaces. So there you are. And yes, with the Yagi, you can, I guess, according to him, achieve a 9-degree elevation angle. Is this 100% true? That's the comparison he says between a Yagi and a quad. He says he was able to achieve a 9-degree elevation takeoff angle. Theoretically, 3 spaces, I don't know, Dick. 3 spaces is something that, you know, sounds like maybe up top of your tower, 3 spaces. In fact, you know, it would be a love. Oh, I love you have the right facility for doing one experiment that would really tickle my ribs. I told you about the experiment I do at a 40-meter dipole of letting it, trying different horizontal, the dipole, 40-meter dipole, I put it horizontal, up to starting at 65 feet horizontally. I then began to lower, remember, one end, as I said, with a pulley. I had the pulley on one end with a cord and a sinker on that end, and I started to make the horizontal dipole into a vertical. And I found that I have an optimized, terrific 40-meter silicone dipole, and it makes an angle of 28 degrees with ground. I made sure I make so many tests with this thing, over and over, up and down. And I'd love to know what happens if you put a dipole on 75 meters and do the same experiment, Dick. It would be phenomenal. I would love to see the result. If you took your dipole, hung it from the top of your tower, you have the height, and drop it down, try it in the vertical, and gradually raise it up, Dick, by some means. what would happen? I really would like to know, I think, over.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I've got the hardware to do that. Now, let's see. If I take my best climbing harness, and then I snug up on the connection, can I make it properly fit a guy that's as skinny as you? I think I can. I've got the harness. I've got the coax going out there. I've got the tower. Are you up for it, Mel?
Make 73. No, I'm not up for it. I saw that picture. Listen, I have showed that picture to so many people, and they say, oh, my God, what's that below him in the garden? I said, no, that's the tree. Oh, he has a beautiful garden. I said, no, that's the top of his tree. Well, how high up is he? I said, well, somewhere around 200 feet. Is he kidding? Is he for real? I said, yeah, he's for real. And is that him standing up there in the middle of the quad? Because it doesn't look like it, you know, that picture was taken a long time ago. So, was that really a picture of you taken standing up at the top on the boom of the of all those elements that on that square frame, Dick, over?
Absolutely, positively, as Jerry would say. A picture was taken in 1980. I set up the tripod in the front yard, stationed the wife there alongside of the camera, and shouted to her as to when to take the shot. I climbed the tower with a ski jacket on with the safety rope around me, got up into the middle of the antenna on that row number 6 tower, the old tower, put my foot on that horizontal rung of the Yagi array and made it look like I'm putting my weight on it. That was thin wall, 1.5-inch diameter tubing. If I really put my weight on it, I would have bent it. My weight wasn't on that horizontal bar. My right-hand foot was on the tower. My left-hand foot was looking like it was on the antenna. The wind was blowing. My hair got ruffled a little bit. But that was me in 1980. No doubt about it. Those trees that you see in the top-down self-portrait picture on the tower, those trees below me that look like grass, those are 85-foot-high trees. You're looking at the tips of trees that are 85 feet above the ground, three guy wire levels below me. Go back and look at that picture again. Back to you, Mel.
Who said while you're up there, you didn't hang a pulley with a nice piece of rope, you know, hanging down one of these Dacron ropes, you know, hanging down so you can pull up, you know, some nice wires up there. Oh, I'd love to see what effect you would have. I'd love to see who that. Get on 75 meters and let's see what happens by you doing the same experiment. I wish I had the height for it because I'd love to do that. Take a vertical, take a dipole and do the same thing. Change the angle. Hang one end of it. In other words, make a vertical dipole and then change the angle. Basically, vary the angle. What happens? Because I was amazed at what happened when I did it with 40-meter experiment. And I always pictured, gee, on the way, but man, how am I going to go up that height there? You know, lucky I went up as high as I am right now. So it would be great if there was a way to do it. Should have hung a pulley up there, I'm telling you, Dick. You could have tried a lot of nice wire experiments over.
All right, well, I have good news for you. As of 3 months ago, the pulley is there, the rope is there, the two ends of the rope are tied around the tree right now. One end is tied around the tree. The other end goes into a bucket that contains a spool of yellow polypropylene rope, and that spool is probably 300 feet long. The rope, the pulley, it's a mountaineering pulley on a carabiner connected to the top rung of the tower, sitting there with the rope, making sure it doesn't get tangled in the tower. It's pulled off at about a 20-degree angle from the tower over to a tree, sitting there, ready to roll right now. Back to you, Mel.
Okay. Gee, you've got it, so you're all set. Oh, I'd love you to put a dipole on that, an 80-meter dipole. I'm the 75, cut it for around 3800. And I'd love you to get on and take it to see what happens to report between my horizontal loop and that vertical dipole. Oh, damn, would that be an experiment, Dick, that I'd love to see the results, because we have discussed it a number of times over and over again. The dipole horizontal, is it better with a vertical? Is there something in between? And it seems like I think there's something in between that would be an antenna of choice. And these guys talk about four square. They do all kinds of things and all. And yes, I see that for your, the bang for the buck, for some reason, some guys, especially with dipoles, slopers of some sort, see them. You know, by hitting this, just from trying it, you know, oh, well, I had a tree that's 75 feet tall, I hung an antenna on there, and I sloped it down and come to within 10 feet, and for some reason, we're getting out tremendous with it. Did they have to hit the magic angle? I don't know. They're going to lose the repeater. I'd love you to try that experiment. This is K2KY.
Sorry, do we open?
Good night, Rich. Let me listen. Reset. Hey, your finger is getting tired, Mel. You're just starting to let loose on that push the torque button that has to be pushed by Arnold Schwarzenegger's hand. Okay. The rope is there. The tower is there. Right now, the rope is sloped off to the side of the tower to the south. But it doesn't have to stay in that direction, but right now it's to the south. To bring it around to any other direction more than 120 degrees away, it's going to have to get it past a bunch of four layers of guy wires. But right now, one set of my guy wires go a little bit west of south, and that rope is going down almost due south right now. And two ends of it tied to the stream with a pulley on the top of the tower. We're ready to roll. And I'm down to my last three safety harnesses, Mel. Back to you for a final. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1179 of the series that began in September of 1982. Assuming that Mel and I stay healthy, we intend to be back next week, and we're going to settle this stuff on the subject of antennas. We're not sure which one we're going to settle. 632 versus 832 screws in our antenna. I think we might settle that one. Hang in there. Bye-bye. You all be kind to each other. K2KUY, you got it.
Hey, good night, all. And Dick, I'm going to keep bothering you. You've got to hang that dipole for 80. I want to hear you on 75 one night with me, and I want to hear what that does. I just want to see that. I have a feeling that we could come up with something here that nobody ever investigated until I did this 40-meter antenna experiment. So I, again, love to repeat that experiment now on TV. 75 meters. So I'm going to keep bothering you. Just to hang a dipole, no big deal. You've got the pulley and everything, you know, unless I have to bring you a roll of wire or something. All right. I should say we'll pick up on this jet next week. 73 is all. Take care. Have a great week. This is K2KY. Good night.